Real people, real opinions. Nighttime Talk with Niall Boylan.
Ireland's classic hits radio.
Now, usually we have an interesting guest at this time of the night, and certainly tonight is no exception. And what Jane does, in case you don't know, she never tells me who the guest is until kind of, you know, an hour before the show. And then she hands me a bit of paper and goes, there you go. Because, and the reason is because I like to be interested, just like everybody else, just like you listening. I like to know very little about the person, you know, apart from a small brief that she might give you, two sheets of paper. And that's it. So James Stephen Lindsay, who I recognize the name actually because he was on Joe Rogan recently, and that's how I recognize him, is an American author. And he is known for something quite humorous and also quite depressing, depending on how you choose to look at it. I mean, that something is known as the Grievance Studies Affair, in which he and two authors, listen to this, submitted hoax articles, now hoax articles, known hoax articles, to academic journals to test how difficult it is to get published with false and, frankly, ludicrous information. Sadly, they discovered it wasn't difficult at all. The lefties were quite willing to publish it and go with it. Lindsay has written several books, including Cynical Theories, and most recently, The Queering of the American Child. Sounds very interesting, doesn't it? He has a lot to say, and I'm delighted to have him on the line. Good evening to you, James.
Hello, good evening.
Lovely to have you on. And by the way, I know you were on Joe Rogan recently, which was very interesting as well. I'm sure that had quite a bit of feedback to it as well after that, because obviously Joe Rogan is probably the biggest podcast in the world. So I'm sure you got quite a lot of feedback to that, did you?
Yeah. You don't go on Joe Rogan and have a quiet month afterwards.
No, I wouldn't imagine so. Well, I can assure you, you won't get the same, I suppose, backlash that you'll get on this show. But certainly Joe Rogan. I think Joe has something like, somebody mentioned the other day, 8 billion downloads a year. That's like the population of the world downloading the show in a year. It's incredible, isn't it? Incredible.
It's truly incredible. He said he's something like 10 to 12 million downloads per episode is pretty typical.
Wow. Wouldn't we all like to be in his bank account? Anyway, getting back, let's talk about, firstly, if I can go back to the Grievance Studies Affair, okay? So what kind of brought you onto this, and why? It's, you know what it sounds like to me? Many, many years ago, there was a band in Europe called KLF when I was a bit younger. And KLF were essentially two producers. And KLF said, we're going to prove that you can be a millionaire overnight just by producing music. That's crap. And they did. And then they went on television and they burnt the £1 million in a furnace and everybody went crazy. But they did it just to prove a point that they had these fancy looking girls miming to the songs that they produced. And that's kind of what you did. You produced these kind of hoax articles. So what were the articles?
Oh my goodness. They were sort of off the charts. One of the most famous one, we said that, you know, there's this problem, allegedly, the feminists say, of rape culture, that our societies somehow support rape. And so we said a good way to find out more about that would be to go study at the dog park, the way that people reacted to watching dogs hump each other at the dog park. And based on whether, you know, they supported the humping, if it was male or female, or if it was straight or gay, you could determine that, in fact, men do support rape culture.
Okay.
They were supported through the dogs. So we should train men the way we train dogs, like with obedience manuals and leashes and the whole thing.
And you had a so-called published paper around this, and you did get it published, and you did send it to these academics, these kind of lefty, woke academics, and they went with it. They thought, this is real.
That's right.
That's right. That's incredible. It's just incredible how gullible they were.
Correct. We also took a chapter of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf and translated it into, rather than talking about the building of the Nazi Party, as he does in the 12th chapter of the book, we changed it to building an intersectional solidarity-based feminism and to put out an 8-point plan for developing what that would look like, derived straight from Hitler. And that was accepted by a feminist social work journal.
Oh, wow. Right. That really made them credible, didn't it? And were they found out? I mean, did you guys go along and say, hey, that's a fake, by the way? I mean, what was the reaction to that when it was kind of found out that it was fake? Or did they manage to cover that up somehow and say, well, it may be fake, but at least it's this, this, and this?
Well, the short answer to that question is that, first of all, no academics figured out that it was fake at all. It was a college student who was working part-time as a journalist online who decided that the paper about the dogs must be fake and just picked at it and picked at it. And finally, she ended up getting a journalist at the Wall Street Journal interested, and the Wall Street Journal contacted the academic journal, which was called Gender, Place, and Culture. And the whole thing started to fall apart very quickly when a real journalist started getting involved. And the reaction from the academics was to, for a few weeks, call us names, say that we were bad people and all of this, but otherwise to ignore it and pretend it never happened.
So you're the bad people for making up this article that they then republished and took seriously, but you were the bad people for doing that.
Yeah, they said that we took advantage of the of their trust and their honesty. And I thought that that was preposterous, since what they're publishing is dishonest in the first place.
Yeah, you took advantage of their wokeness is what you took advantage of. That's what you because woke people will jump on any social justice. You know that as well as I do. So, I mean, going back to one of your books, for example, The Queering of American Children, or American Child, should I say. I mean, I suppose what you talked about, and I remember there was one of the things that you had mentioned, was this idea that we treat the whole world like it's sick. And that example of a doctor that would, say, examine the whole population of America would find cancer in 10%. Whereas if you left them alone, they'd probably be fine. But if you treat the 10%, well, some of them might die because they now know they have cancer. So this idea that we're treating the whole of the population or the whole of people who have a gender issue like they're sick when we shouldn't be.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, with cancer, it's very simple, is that there are more, if you screen the entire population, this is what I said to Joe Rogan, if you screen the entire population for something like cancer, it turns out you'll find way more false positives than you'll find true positives. And this is a basic known fact of statistics. I used to teach this when I taught mathematics at university many years ago. And so you don't want to do universal screening. But what's happening in our schools is they say in the name of, you know, LGBTQ empathy, that we have to give gay curriculum and sexual curriculum, explicitly sexual curriculum sometimes, based in things like the theory of pleasure, which sounds completely inappropriate for children because it is.
That
we have to give this to all the kids. Because there might be a small number of kids who don't feel represented or recognized if we don't. And it's the same thing as doing a universal cancer screening, or it'd be even, it's more like giving chemotherapy to everybody in the hopes that you cure the cancers that one or two people have. And in a typical school, there would be a handful of these children that, you know, maybe are questioning some things and they're confused. And the correct way to deal with that would be to identify them individually and, you know, counsel with their parents and try to figure out a solution if they're having trouble. And if they're not having trouble, they'll just leave them alone. Mm-hmm. But instead, what they want to do is broadcast this to everybody. And the equivalent is, like I said, giving a drug to the entire population so that it will cure the small number of people who are sick.
It's kind of like teaching children, you know, that, you know, a small number of children will die before they reach the age of 10. Very small number of children will die before they reach. So it's like preparing the whole class to die. Just in case you happen to be one of them. And it just sounds like the maddest right. thing in the world. But it's happening everywhere. It's not just in the United States. Here in Ireland, of course, we're changing the school curriculum as well to be more representative of, you know, not being gender normative, as they call it. In other words, that, you know, you can be any gender you want to be, which most logical people believe is completely untrue. But that's causing a big problem in America because, of course, Donald Trump is now using that as part of his campaign, that he said he will defund any school that starts to teach this.
Yeah, well, it's become a big international issue, like you said, and part of my work has been tracing the roots of that. It is a big issue in the U.S. because the Republican side is now fighting back and the Democrats are pushing it forward, and so it's a very divisive issue. But the fact is, like you said, it's happening in Ireland. It's happening everywhere. I was in London back in November, at the beginning of the month of November last year, and I met with a man from Kenya, and he said it was happening in Kenya.
Wow.
And I thought, well, how can that be? And I got thinking about it, and there's an answer to that question, because this sexuality education curriculum is actually not coming from our governments directly. It's coming from the United Nations. So all of the United Nations member states are taking up what they call comprehensive sexuality education, which was created and pushed by UNESCO starting in 2003. So this actually is an international move, not just across Western nations, but across African nations, across South American nations. But it's probably the strongest in the English-speaking nations.
I did see an article the other day, actually, about a gender swap day in a school. It turned out to be in South Africa. And it was a gender swap day where kids in primary school were basically encouraged on this particular day for boys to come in dressed as girls and girls to come in dressed as boys. And I thought, That's not something I would have expected in South Africa. Yes, and don't ask me why, by the way, but I would expect that more in London or somewhere a little bit more woke than South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, the target is everywhere, and so you'll see it everywhere. And the point of that exercise, it sounds like it's maybe innocuous and just some fun, but that's actually how they can hide a deeper agenda. And the deeper agenda in this case is to get people, getting children, to do this, to go through the activity, and then to start asking questions like, is this more normal? Maybe this is something I like. Mm. It's to introduce the idea to them and to get the discussion going. It's also to find out which kids will say, I'm not going to participate in that, and create a division. And so they call these in the academic literature generative themes in education. So you create a generative opportunity. The so-called drag queen story time that made the news for the last 2 years is presented in its own literature as a generative opportunity for children to have an introduction to what they call queer world making and living queerly and queer aspects of themselves, and something else they refer to as embodied kinship, which is an alternate. They say that the practice of drag queen story hour or time in schools is a preparatory introduction to alternate modes of kinship. And that's in their own words, which I, of course, got in trouble. I got thrown off Twitter a year or so ago for calling that grooming.
I'm assuming you were allowed back on again when Elon Musk took over.
That's correct. Yeah. Elon Musk took over. I was in London then, too. And then he let me back on the day after I got back from London.
And what I'm thinking about is, when you see, particularly in America, we haven't seen so much of that here yet, the drag queen story time, right? There has been some, but it's been reasonably innocent, right? But some of the drag queen stuff that I've seen on videos in American schools, you know, I've seen one guy and he was dressed as a woman in a bikini with his testicles hanging out on either side of some sort of G-string, right? And these mothers are sitting with their 4 and 5 year olds smiling and happy. These are the same social justice warriors that would be appalled by any inappropriate behavior by anybody towards a child, but yet they would put their child down in front of a grown man with his testicles hanging out.
Yeah, well, this is the cult of inclusion. That's the word, inclusion, inclusivity. The idea of these poor parents, what they're doing is signaling to the world that they won't reject somebody just because they're gay. They won't reject their child just because they're gay. Like, lady, this is the 2020s. Nobody's done that forever. We've moved on. That's 30 years ago. But they feel like they have to signal it. And they are caught by this concept that they're a bad person if they don't say yes to everything that comes down out of that agenda, that they're the same kind of bad person who might reject their child or disown their child if they came out gay or if they said that they were unsure about their gender.
And why do you think, particularly, now I've been doing a talk show for the last 25 years, right? But, and I've never known anything like what's happening in the last, say, 5 to 7 years. And I think it's particularly social media drives a lot of this, right? But why do you think, you know, social justice, wokeness, why has it become such a big thing in the last 5 years? My theory on it was, and I'm an atheist, but Ireland was a very religious country. We're now probably one of the most wokest countries in the world. We're allegedly progressive. They confuse the word progressive with wokeness in this country. But anyway, I think it's because people have lost religion and need to follow something else. As human beings, we need to follow something. If it's not veganism, it's social justice, it's climate change, it's gender critical issues. Why do you think we're following, or some people are following this wokeness?
I don't doubt that what I just said is, or that what you just said is part of it. I think that is part of it. People are searching for meaning. People are looking for a way to feel like a good person and to contribute to the positive aspects of society, much like they would through their religion. They're looking for community and organization. Churches are actually the oldest form of community organizing, as they call it over here on the left, in existence. So, there's an aspect of that, but I'm much more prosaic about this. Why has this taken off in the last 5 years? Social media, of course, contributes. It's much more simple than that. People started dumping rivers of money into making it go big. That's how. There are people who realized the destructive potential of this, and they started funding it with very large sums of money very quickly. Roughly about 10 years ago. And so we started to see the fruit of it 5 or 6 years ago in virtually every
domain of life. Why would they do that? I mean, this is what makes me really curious, James. Because so you've got philanthropists out there who are pumping money. George Soros obviously being the obvious name, right? So you've got philanthropists pumping money into this kind of stuff, right? Or promoting this social justice. But what's in it for them? That I've often wondered. That's the I don't disagree with that's happening. And I'm absolutely sure that's what's happening. But what's in it for them? To destroy society? Why would they want to do that?
It's a funny thing you ask. I've been researching Soros himself specifically, and he's a little bit of a different kind of character. The short answer to your question, which we have to be careful to distinguish Soros here, but the short answer to your question is that what's happening in the West is a cultural revolution like happened in China in the 1960s. It is an attack on our Western culture in order to try to destroy it. It is primarily communist and driven by people who support a new global communism that looks like China. It's supported by the CCP. We know that. It's funded also by Russia. We know that. It's also funded by these billionaire philanthropists, including George Soros. Now, George Soros's idea is what he calls reflexivity, which is, in a nutshell, that if you can push the conditions of an environment, a society, a country, a city, into chaos, people don't, this is what he says in his book, The Alchemy of Finance, they don't know what to do in a situation of chaos. They don't know how to orient their lives. So then you can deposit guideposts into their lives to direct them to the conclusions that you want them to have. That's what he did with the markets, is that he would decide that he would start to sense that there was a weakness in a particular company or its stock or the pound sterling, and famously in the late 1980s. And what he was going to do is then he would start to, you know, place his bets in the market, so to speak, as an investor, short bets, long bets, the other bets, investments straight out. And then what he would do is start telling articles, oh, I think this is going to happen, I think that's going to happen, and try to push the system into chaos. And then he would put more, he'd go give opinions on TV. This is the way I think things will go. But what he was actually doing was saying, this is the way I want the market to behave so it goes in the way that my bets line up to. So he wants to drive our societies, and these other, if they are communists, want to drive our societies into instability and chaos, because in those conditions, you can direct it toward system change, whether that's a communist revolution, whether that's George Soros's vision of a new open society, which is what he calls it. He says he's not a communist, but that he uses Marx's methods. He also explains that in Alchemy of Finance. So it's the same methodology.
So it's a social conditioning. Essentially, it's exactly what religion did many, many years ago, which was to socially condition people into a moral way of thinking so they'd be thankful for anything they had.
Right, but the first step is to make everything miserable, so that you can condition them the way that you want them to go. Because people were in the West, we've been having, you know, everything's not perfect, but we had pretty good lives. So you have to make it unstable. That's their activity now. And then when it's unstable, they can direct it in the pathways that they want it to go into. You unleash crime, for example, in our cities. We know that this is a big problem in the U.S. I don't know how bad it is in Ireland. And then you have the police are defunded. It's an accusation that the police are racist or that there are other awful things. So what can you do? Well, we don't want to put in police, so we'll put in cameras. We'll put in facial tracking cameras that won't open doors unless we know who you are. And they get a surveillance system out of it. So that's
are you saying that all of these things that we're seeing currently happening in the world, and of course climate policy and all this sort of stuff, you know, and we've seen in China the social credits also being used now, where people literally have social credits on their app on their phone, and they're only allowed to use a certain amount per week, and have a certain amount of flights, and have a certain amount of use of supermarkets. You're saying that's all on the way, because a lot of people would say, James, you know, that's conspiracy theory stuff. But then again, most of the stuff that I've heard that were conspiracy theories 10 years ago have actually probably come true.
Yeah, well, I am saying that that's what's happening. If people want to call me a conspiracy theorist, I tell them to go, as they say in Australia, to go check the scoreboard, and as you were indicating, and see how many of these things have actually come to pass. Oh, that James, he's a conspiracy theorist. Well, they flip on their phone, and it has a social credit system built on it, and they're introducing a central currency right now. I mean, I'm a little bit hesitant to accept that kind of an accusation when it's actually unfolding before our eyes, just maybe not as neatly and cleanly as
it almost suggests that all these organizations, like, say, the WHO and the World Economic Forum and all these other places are all in, or NATO and the United Nations are all in some sort of cahoots. And I find that difficult to believe. I'm not doubting, by the way, it's possible, but I find it difficult to believe, because for this kind of thing to happen, for the world to change and just to be socially conditioned into a different way of thinking and be thankful for what we have, et cetera, et cetera, you would have to have all of these organizations working together as one, wouldn't you?
Well, you only need a few people to be able to get a lot of people to do what you want, if you know how to, if the people that you have can align the incentives in the direction you want them to go. For example, virtually every corporation in the United States, which is supposed to be a bastion of freedom, orients its entire business model around what will suit the Chinese Communist Party, because they can't get into the Chinese market and that 1.3 billion people that are consumers there now without satisfying the CCP business firewall. So it only takes a few members of the CCP to say, well, if you want to do business with our 1.3 billion people in China, this is what you're going to do, to get every corporation in the United States to jump. Now you add in, with, you mentioned the World Economic Forum, but you add in the United Nations with their, what do they call it, the ESG, environmental social governance policies. And what you've built is a social credit system and set of incentives for the corporations themselves to all do the thing. Mm-hmm. And the same thing. And in fact, the governance policy, this is a document I was just reviewing the other day from Harvard from 2019. And this document from Harvard was instructing that what would be the correct way to go, and we know this is actually happening, it's not a conspiracy, it's actually what's happening, is that your governance score, the G part of ESG, the scoring goes up if you're an executive who gives yourself corporate bonuses for installing ESG policies in your company. And the numbers, at, for example, Boeing, can swing to plus 10% or minus 10%, depending on how compliant you are. Boeing, of course, is in a lot of hot water. So that's a 22-point swing, if you actually do the math, a 22% increase in how much you get paid as an executive year after year if you implement ESG versus if you refuse to. So all you actually need is a small number of people who are at the most elite of the elite, cooperating at the highest levels with either the CCP or the United Nations, which are working together as well, to align the incentives so that it's very difficult to play in, say, the market, or very difficult to do business at scale outside of those policies. And then it's trickle down to the people from there.
But there is, we're watching a little bit of a fight back in the world, and I agree with nearly everything you said there, by the way. They're bringing in that kind of social policies as well, particularly in the United Kingdom with the LGBTQ community, where you get these kind of stars or grades for your company if you're more compliant with, say, gender pronouns and all this kind of stuff, that you get a star. In other words, we're not going to boycott you if you do these things. You get a grade. But in saying that, there is a little bit of a fight back. And we're seeing that across the world. I don't know whether you're seeing it in the United States, but certainly across Europe we're seeing it, where we're seeing presidents, we're seeing, you know, politicians being elected who are right of centre rather than being left of centre, because people are kind of getting tired of all of this stuff. So we're kind of seeing the pendulum swing back a little bit now over the last 6 or 7 months. And we're seeing it right here in Ireland at the moment, because we're currently in political chaos in this country. Because for that very reason, the government tried to bring in hate speech laws. And I'm sure you may have read about them. I know Elon Musk was commenting on the Irish hate speech laws, and he said he would personally pay for anybody to take a case to court against the government. We're now seeing political chaos in this country, and a lot of politicians backtracking now, saying they don't agree with the hate speech laws because they're trying to get elected again. So we're seeing that across the world now, a bit of backtracking going on the kind of wokeness. Are you seeing that in America?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Right now, actually, there's an article that came out today from, I forget where it came out from, but they were saying specifically that the Democrats are trying to gear up to make sure that Donald Trump can't steal the election, which means they're also laying down the idea that they think Donald Trump might win big so they can then discredit the election as stolen when he wins big. The pushback, for example, the swing in Michigan has been almost 9 or 10 points, Michigan, mm-hmm. of course, being one of those toss-up states in the previous yep. election. It has now swung 9 or 10 points. It favors Donald Trump very strongly, 55 to 44 or something like that. It's an incredible swing that we're seeing state after state after state after state. I travel the country and speak in virtually every state on a regular basis now. I've hit the 44 of the states out of the 50, and I see the energy rising. I see people mobilizing. I see people doing ballot initiatives. I see people just doing everything they can to turn the tide back the other way, and the polling actually reflects that very, very strongly. So the pushback is strong here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There's also a strong pushback in Canada, which is more surprising, particularly
yeah.
in Alberta.
One of the wokest countries in the world, in Canada. I mean,
yes.
I mean, realistically, I mean, I know people, I know that famous story of that man who was going to be jailed because he wouldn't affirm the gender identity of his daughter stroke son. So that just goes to show you what Canada's like. But you actually said that you'd vote for Trump in the 2020 election, arguing that the danger of wokeness was much greater than Trump as a president. And are you going to vote for him again?
Yeah, I think so. If he's on the ticket, if they can't keep him off of it, for certain.
There's only two things that'll keep him off it at the moment, and that's either sickness or assassination. I mean, they're the only two things that are going to keep him off the ticket.
Yeah, well, they tried to indict him for a number of things, and that all fell through. And now that it appears that they're trying to bankrupt him, and that's probably going to backfire as well with this $400+ million settlement that the Attorney General of New York came out with. But it looks very much like that's going to get challenged on what we call Eighth Amendment grounds, that it's an excessive fine, and it might actually get New York in trouble and not Donald Trump. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, I kind of agree with you.
But hasn't he just floated Truth Social on the stock exchange, and they reckon he's going to get about $2 or $3 billion out of that?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So I think he's going to be okay for money. I don't think money's going to be an issue for old Donald. He seems to be doing really, really well. And his main issue that he seems to be doing on, which is a worldwide issue, it's not just an American issue, it's happening here in Ireland as well, is immigration. Immigration seems to be the one thing, because, of course, he's accused Joe Biden of secretly chartering planes and bringing people in on purpose into the United States. He talks about people coming into the United States that come from, where does he say, institutions and asylums. He doesn't seem to care what he says. And he just says what he wants to say and gets away with it. I mean, do you think immigration is going to be the hot ticket or issue this year for the elections?
I think it's really shaping up to be. We have a... At this point, we can say a full-scale invasion, now that we've had actually illegal immigrants coming to the border and being held back by the National Guard of Texas and then overrunning them in El Paso. So that's actually not, those can't be asylum seekers if they're taking soldiers down to get in. That's actually an invasion. And it's become a very pertinent problem. We, of course, have the fentanyl problem that's coming across from the cartels across the border. We know that that's fueled by China. We know that there are Chinese soldiers coming across the border pretending to be asylum seekers from South America, that are infiltrating our country. We know that there are major problems. And now we see all these things about squatters' rights that are making people very angry. We're seeing the criminal aliens committing murders and rapes and then not being held to any legal account. I think it's going to be a very big issue in this coming election. And for very good reasons. It appears that when I talked to Joe Rogan about the so-called Cloward-Piven strategy of overloading the system with expenses and immigrants and debt all at the same time in order to collapse it, which is an old communist strategy for taking down a country. I think that that's what people are starting to realize is playing out, and they're very likely many of them will vote accordingly.
But you could argue that when Donald Trump was in power the last time, you know, people were still coming across the border. There was still a huge issue in Texas at the border. There were still problems. I mean, he didn't fix it then. So what makes us think he's going to fix it now? Now, I know COVID got in his way to some degree towards the second portion of his presidency. But in saying that, what makes you think that he's going to do it this time or sort out the problem of illegal immigration?
Well, there's two things to say about that. The first is the question isn't whether or not he'll sort out the problem of illegal immigration as much as people hope he can, and I hope he can. The question is, can he do better than Joe Biden, who's actually fighting Texas? Joe Biden is openly fighting against Texas to keep the border open, to tell Texas it cannot secure its own border, which, of course, impacts the lives of Texas citizens. So will Donald Trump do better than the Democrats, Joe Biden, presumably? Well, yes, absolutely. He will at least make an attempt to control the border. Secondly, the more important point is, I think he may actually be more successful than people think. Part of the reason he was less successful is because he tried to play that game with a very resistant executive apparatus that he had around him, administrative apparatus that wasn't going along with a lot of what he was doing and was holding him back. And as the Democrats have made quite clear, they're very scared of the fact that he, under a brand name called Project 2025, has a plan to hit the ground running to make sure that the administrative apparatus is something that he has more control over than he did in his previous term of president. So he should be able to achieve a lot more, especially in the first 100 days or 2 years of his next term.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, I know you had mentioned on Joe Rogan, you talked about this idea of tagging people, you know, and this kind of normalization of tagging people who would come to a country. I don't know whether any country would, well, I don't think here in Ireland they'd get away with that. Any government would even suggest that they wouldn't get away with it.
No, yeah, I don't know that they'll do that. I just know that one of the strategies that you see some of the states talking about, which I haven't heard it from the federal government, is to use this program that they call E-Verify, which would mean that in order to know who is in the country, that you have to verify them with an electronic ID that separates the legal from the illegal. And then what would happen would be up to the administration and its policies in terms of deportations and other things. As for another example, Joe Biden, the news just broke 2-3 days ago, forgot to file the paperwork to deport some 200,000 apprehended illegal aliens that were in the country that had been caught and were to be deported, and he just forgot to file the paperwork.
Well,
or his departments did. And so technically there's a loophole, so they had to be released.
Well, at least it's deported. A little bit different to here. You know, I don't know if you're familiar, James, with Ireland, but we have deportation orders that we give to people, but they're voluntary. So in other words, we tell people, I'm sorry, you failed, you don't qualify as an asylum seeker, here's a deportation order, on your way. But that's it. We just hand it to them and they go off. And we don't know whether they've left. The question was asked of the state recently, how many people who got deportation orders actually left the state? And the answer came back from the government, we don't know. We don't follow it up. I mean, that's how important we believe the issue is in this country. But it's really important, and it's going to become one of the big political debates in this country over the next 6 months, because we have a general election at the end of the year, most likely. So it is going to be a huge problem in this country. Immigration seems to be the problem everywhere. But look, I have to say, your books seem really interesting. I'm certainly going to grab a look at them myself since we've had a chat. Cynical Theories. Just explain briefly what Cynical Theories is about, by the way, for those who don't know.
Well, Cynical Theories came out in 2020, and it is a book about the postmodern philosophy roots of all of woke. So it gives a very relatively brief history of critical race theory and queer theory and post-colonial theory and the fat studies and so on that we all hear about all the time now, the woke theories. And it came out right in the midst of the George Floyd riots. So it actually had a lot of reach. I think it's sold 500,000 copies worldwide in 27 languages now or something. So it's really really reached a lot of people.
And the second book, The Creator of the American Child, I'm assuming that's in relation to what we spoke about earlier on, which was this idea of, you know, bringing it into schools and kind of normalizing this idea that you can change gender.
Yeah, that's right. The idea is that there's a academic subject, I just mentioned it, called queer theory. A lot of people don't know what it is, but what's happening in the schools is happening under the rules of queer theory. Queer theory is being brought into and practiced on our children. And the case that we make is that queer theory is the doctrine of a religious cult that is based on sex, that primarily targets children, and that almost has nothing to do with gay people.
No, there's a stark difference, and I know people get everything all confused. I mean, the idea that we would confuse children, and you were right in what you said earlier on, if children need support or have an issue, you know, and they have an issue with their gender, we support those individual children, and we should support those children and try and help and support those children any way we can. But the idea that you would talk to everybody about it and almost encourage the problem seems quite bizarre. But look, they're doing it everywhere in the world. We can see that. Look, it's been a pleasure talking to you, James, and thank you very much indeed, and hopefully we'll get to chat again.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
James, thank you very
much. Now, real people, real opinions. Nighttime Talk with Niall Boylan.
Ireland's classic hits radio.